Hello, everyone. Dave Levinsky from GrowthInc here, and today I'm really excited to be able to interview Greg Martin. Greg is a partner with Redpoint Ventures, which is a $2 billion venture capital fund, which has offices in Los Angeles, Silicon Valley, and Shanghai, China. And that's where Greg focuses on information technology, communications, and digital media investments. Greg also has direct entrepreneurial experience, having owned and operated a high-end men's clothing franchise in the Los Angeles area. So based on Greg's background, both as a venture capitalist and as an entrepreneur, I thought he would be a great person to interview regarding raising venture capital. So I'm really excited to speak with Greg today. So to start, Greg, thanks again for taking the time to speak with me.
Sure, Dave. Thanks a lot for having me. It's a pleasure to speak to you and to hopefully reach your entrepreneurial community.
Excellent. So Greg, my first question is, as a venture capitalist, what are the four or five keys that you're looking for when considering an investment into a company?
You know, I would say I focus probably on three key items, and you know, the fourth is probably related to the deal. You know, and the first one is market. I look at the opportunity to grow a really big business into a market, and so I evaluate whether the market opportunity is large enough, you know, to grow a new business into that market. So market size is critical. The second component is the team. You know, the management team, their business savvy, their entrepreneurial wisdom, their knowledge of the market. You know, track record helps because it, you know, it suggests that they've proven themselves before, but it's not the most important thing. You know, you can sense everyone needs to be a CEO for the first time at some point. So it's, but it certainly is a good predictor of future success. So the team's ability to, you know, take a vision and sort of move it into a big market, a big company is important. The third component, I think, is, you know, what I would call a competitive advantage. So whether it's a technology or a unique distribution strategy or some other unique business model that we believe can enable the company to have an unfair competitive advantage in the marketplace, because over time that's what enables them to sustain a position, to sustain growth, and to sustain a premium margin model, which you know, is what we value highly. So I think those are the three key components we look for. And then, of course, the final component, obviously, is whether there's a, you know, those three determine whether we want to be in the business at all. And then the fourth one is whether there's a, you know, a deal structure that kind of works for the entrepreneur and works for us. And sometimes it doesn't, and but hopefully it does, and that's what enables us to make the investment if we're interested based on the other three criteria.
Excellent. Can I ask you a question on the first criteria, the
sure.
market size? When you're talking about, is it big enough? Are you looking at the current market size or projections for the current market, or is it mostly if it's a new type of technology that may create a new market? Maybe you can talk about, you know, whether it's an existing market or new market when you say the market's big enough.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, a lot of it ends up being both. I mean, the reality is a lot of the companies we invest in are sort of taking an existing market. There's an existing need in the market for a solution, and they might be doing it a different way. They might be a substitute, if you will, for how things are done, you know, how things are currently done. So that's sort of looking at an existing market and how much is being spent to solve a certain problem, you know, in that market. And then, you know, the companies we invest in often are solving the problem in a new, more efficient, better way. But at least you get a sense of what people are currently paying. Now, obviously, there are new markets that are created when you have a completely new industry or technology that is formed. You know, like when the internet first came around, for example, there was no advertising, you know, on the internet, and sort of those were new markets. But then the reality is there was an offline advertising market, so we were just taking dollars from the offline world and bringing it online. So there still were existing markets to look at in terms of evaluating the market size of what then became a new market. I suppose a true new market is if someone discovered the cure for cancer. You know, you wouldn't necessarily know how much that's worth. You could look at what, you know, what is being spent currently, but, you know, that would be solving solving an old problem a new way, or not even solving an old problem. That would actually be solving a problem that's never been solved before. But that would be an example of a new market. So I think we, you know, we look at, when we look at market sizes, we look at how the problem has been addressed in the past as a way of sort of determining what the magnitude of the market is, even if it sort of is seen as a new market.
Got it. Excellent. What are some surefire signs that a company is not a fit for venture capital and or Redpoint Ventures?
I think, and I have this, I'm very candid with my with the entrepreneurs that come into our office, because I think venture capital is certainly not for everybody. Venture capitalists or institutional investors in general, you know, they're looking for exit opportunities, and they're looking for things that can grow to multiple hundreds of millions of dollars in size in terms of market capitalization potential. And I think the reality is most startup companies do not have that potential. And so, and frankly, most entrepreneurs, they don't want to make the sacrifices necessary to reach that potential. And so I think it's very important that the entrepreneur, you know, have a sense of whether their business and they in particular have the wherewithal to build a business of that size. And so that's usually the first sign that it's not going to work. I see a lot of great businesses, a lot of great entrepreneurs who come in, and I say, look, this is a great business. You're going to make a lot of money on it, but it's not a venture business, because there's not a, you know, exit in 5 to 7 years for multiple hundreds of millions of dollars, which is what we target. And that's the only way that we can move the needle on our funds, is to invest in companies that can be that size. Because the reality is, you know, most of the investments we make are not going to work out. So we need to make sure that when the ones that do work out, they work out at that level, at that magnitude. So I think that's usually the surest sign that it's not going to make sense for the entrepreneur to work with us, is that the business itself just doesn't have the profile of growing, as I said, to a market cap of hundreds of millions of dollars or more in a 5 to 7 year period. And that means there needs to be a ready and able exit environment, either M&A or, you know, or it needs to be probably even a bigger size these days, probably 500 million or greater, to go public. And so those are pretty key criteria. And a lot of, when it comes to the wherewithal, the entrepreneurs need to realize that we may make drastic changes with management, including, you know, removing the entrepreneur from the CEO role. And we may need to raise a lot of money, which could require a lot of dilution and a lot of dilution not only in ownership but in control. And these are all factors that an entrepreneur would need to consider, because, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs like running the business. They like to be in control. And even though we're not seeking control necessarily, over time, as you raise more and more money, the investor group will begin to have more and more control of the business. And, you know, the entrepreneurs need to be open to that. And, you know, it's what we do best, which is help companies grow to really large size, but for some, that might not work for them.
Got it. Now, in terms of raising more and more rounds of capital, mm-hmm. what is your role if you fund, you know, an early, let's call it a Series A round for a company? What is your role as the VC in assisting with, you know, Series B, C, D, and beyond?
Well, we're very active. I mean, I think that's a big criteria that an entrepreneur should look at when choosing a venture capital firm, is look at their track record of helping companies get a Series B and beyond round done. I think that's a really important thing, is the ability to obviously not only get the Series A done, but to get the Series B, C, and beyond done efficiently. And, you know, the venture capital firm should provide significant sponsorship for that. So, I mean, firstly, we provide sponsorship. So after we make a Series A investment, it says something about the company that we've hopefully validated the company by doing that, and therefore it gets on the radar screen of folks that we work with to do follow-ons, and reduces the risk of the deal. So we sponsor the deal. We also in a Series B would certainly introduce the company to a lot of folks that we work with a lot of firms that typically follow on to our deals or participate in deals with us, co-investors, if you will. We continually spend a lot of time in the background cultivating new relationships with folks that maybe we haven't worked with before. So we'll get a sense for who is interested in what types of deals and hopefully help the company target the right investors for that next round of financing. We'll also usually participate pro rata in terms of retaining our ownership, so we'll be there to write more, put more money into the company in future rounds to help support the round, which gives the company the necessary leverage to optimize valuation in the future rounds, and also gives other investors the comfort of knowing that existing investors are still believe in the company and are continuing to finance the company. And in some cases, if the market's really difficult, and of course we've been through a period of that, there may be a need to actually insider finance the business where, the cycle time for raising money is too great a burden for the management team, and the valuation environment is such that there isn't a likelihood of a markup, and therefore there's not a lot of advantage to going outside unless there's a significant need for additional capital beyond what the internal group can sort of bring to bear on its own. So I think the venture capital firm is extremely important in raising future rounds of financing for all the reasons that I cited, and I think it's a key criteria that an entrepreneur should look at when choosing their Series A partner.
Excellent. You mentioned insider finance the business. That mean that the venture capital firm puts in more money into the portfolio company, or is that something else?
That's right. That means the existing firms who invested may put more money into the company. Now, that's not the optimal scenario, obviously, because at that point, the venture capitalists are on both sides of the table. On the one side, they're investors in the company and equity holders, but then they're also kind of new investors, and so it's always a little bit tricky in terms of determining what the right pricing is in that situation.
Got it. Well, you also mentioned, co-investors and finding the right investors. When you're looking for co-investors, what are you looking for? We always talk to entrepreneurs about not just seeking, capital, but, seeking smart money. What are you looking for? Are there skill sets that other VCs have or connections?
Sure.
What are your criteria when assessing co-investors?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're looking for, just like an entrepreneur should look for, we're looking for folks that can add value. And so people that either have significant, domain experience in a particular category where they can open doors, incremental doors that we might not be able to open. So whether it's customers or partners or suppliers, folks that they might have relationships with that can bring more, more of a valuable network to bear, in a company situation. We're also looking for folks that are reliable investors. People that will, close a financing in a timely basis. They will act rationally. They will support the company in the future, reserve enough capital to do so. They'll be around. I mean, these days you have to be concerned whether firms will have commitments from LPs, hold up in this marketplace, whether they'll be able to raise incremental funds in the future. Also, you look at incremental sponsorship value, just like we think that when Redpoint makes an investment in the company, it we stamp our brand on the company, and that brand has some value in the marketplace. If we believe that another firm can sort of also add more sponsorship value to a firm, to a company in the marketplace, that's something else we care about. And then there's just the personal relationships of a board has to have good chemistry, and just like an entrepreneur should choose a venture capitalist that they can work with and work with at a board level, it's a little bit like a marriage. You got to choose your partner and you got to be able to work with them appropriately. It's not just money. We feel the same way about co-investment partners. How are they going to be on the board? How are they going to work together? Are they going to, be good, positive for the dynamic or negative for the dynamic? So those are all things we kind of think about when we choose co-investment partners.
Excellent. Can you sort of back up a little bit here in this question? Can you walk us through the process of going from the first point of contact with a VC to an investment? So starting from where the entrepreneur, gets in touch with you to you know, in-person meetings and second meetings and term sheets. Can you just walk through that process?
Yeah, I think, and I'll make another point here. It's important when entrepreneurs sort of think about, you know, who they're going to work with in terms of, you know, legal work, real estate, you know, consulting, IT services, you know, accounting work, whatever it might be. That in addition to, you know, considering them for those services, if they do have plans to go and raise money institutionally, that they work with folks who have good relationships with the venture community, because I think it's very helpful, because we get deals through a variety of sources, but, you know, probably our main source is through sort of trusted referrals, and, you know, these can include attorneys and, you know, IT consultants and other entrepreneurs that we invest in, and, you know, folks like you, Dave, and, you know, people that we know that know us, that we know that when they send us something, there's some sort of pre-validation, you know, in those materials and in that company. And so that tends to be our sort of most fruitful source of deals. We look at everything that comes in. We get emails over the transom. We get, you know, phone calls, you know, cold calls, et cetera, which we still also look at. But the reality is we have a greater sense of a filter when it comes from someone we know. So I think it's important for entrepreneurs to pick people not only based on the services they provide, but also, you know, how they can help them raise money. So deal comes in through a variety of sources. You know, we have a team of people that kind of evaluate the deal, you know, kind of on the criteria that I mentioned. You know, I think we have a sense of really interesting, you know, we're very proactive in terms of things we want to do. So we have some theses on particular markets. We'd like to solve this problem, that problem. And so we have a certain radar screen for those types of deals. If we see something that sort of addresses that, that probably gets, you know, top priority. We also, you know, certainly look at, like I said, anything that sort of tweaks the top three criteria, being, you know, really big market opportunity, really interesting management team, and, you know, unique competitive advantage. So, I mean, those are kind of the three criteria, and we're filtering through deals to kind of find those components. And then we really, you know, I probably personally get 1,000 deals a year. And, you know, something like 20 a week. And, you know, like I said, I have a team of people that kind of filter through initially some of these deals to sort of bring the top ones to bear, or to the surface, I should say. But our philosophy in any event is we want to get back to entrepreneurs quickly, even if it's a no. So even the ones we may not decide to do, we very quickly try and get back, and with hopefully some amount of feedback, although it's hard to do it on, you know, 20 new deals a week. We do the best we can. But anyway, the next, I think after deciding that the deal has some interesting merits, we would bring the team in for a meeting, probably just one partner or a couple partners initially. And then, you know, the they would come in, hopefully have some sort of presentation that they would give us. I think we would expect that, that kind of hits on, frankly, the highlights of what I mentioned. You know, describe the market opportunity, size it, why it's interesting, why you can build a really interesting new company from startup into that market. Obviously, give us an overview of the management team and your relevant skills and characteristics and experience that, you know, that would lead us to believe that you're the right team for this, and obviously describe the sort of unique competitive advantage. So, I mean, I think those are key. And then, you know, we always like entrepreneurs to take a stab at sort of how big the business can be over what period of time. And, you know, while all these are sort of guesses in many senses, I think the reason we like, you know, entrepreneurs to sort of take a look at sort of financial projections, it's more just to test their thoughtfulness. It's a little bit of a credibility check. So, but I think it's worthwhile, even though we don't necessarily believe the numbers are accurate. And so I think after that, after a first meeting, if it's, you know, I think we have a good sense by now, having seen as many deals as we do and, you know, really focused in certain areas of what's interesting and what's not, it's a very quick, you know, I think this makes sense to elevate to the rest of the group, and then it's probably a couple of more meetings with some additional partners, and then probably one final meeting with an overall partnership, and then sprinkled in there, we would be doing our diligence on the market, talking to customers, hopefully, certainly evaluating the management with references, and you know, building up as much data as possible. But I think we're a firm that wants to move quickly. We pretty much know most markets in advance, whether we want to be in them or not. And so our feeling is, you know, in 3 to 4 weeks, you know, we should be able to get to a term sheet with a company. And then the question is whether there's a, you know, a deal that can work for entrepreneurs and for us on the valuation and structure side. So, I mean, I think, you know, I think a typical process is probably 4 weeks to a term sheet and, you know, 2 to 3, and if there's agreement, then 2 to 3 weeks after that, we can close depending on, you know, the speed at which lawyers can produce legal documents, basically. That's kind of the process.
Excellent. That's great. Now, a question I have, a follow-up on that, has to do with the term sheet. I think a lot of entrepreneurs are confused about two key issues in the term sheet. I think everyone understands valuation, but I think there's a lot of confusion about liquidation preference and no-shop agreements, lock-up rights. Can you talk about those issues and what an entrepreneur should be thinking about when they negotiate those issues?
Well, I mean, I'll start with the no-shop. So the no-shop is, that's just really a period of exclusivity. So, you know, if we're gonna sort of spend the money and the time to dig into some of the deeper due diligence, hire lawyers, do all that work, we expect that when a term sheet's signed, that we have some period where the company is not out soliciting other term sheets. So they're kind of agreeing that, hey, we're going to work with you guys for the next 3 or 4 weeks. If we make a commitment to them that we're going to try and close the deal in 3 weeks, that, or 4 weeks, or whatever the time is, and that's usually the time that we would have in the exclusivity period. It's probably 30 days.
Okay, so I've heard as much as 120
days. Yeah, well,
that's not the way we
work for Series A deals. Right. No, it's probably more like
30 days. What would
you
think is reasonable for an entrepreneur?
I would say 30 days, and I would say if it's more than 30 days, then the venture firm is not they haven't completed their business due diligence. Usually, when we give an entrepreneur a term sheet in a Series A situation, it's because we've agreed to do the deal. We've done the business due diligence. We're just doing the more legal stuff where we're digging into contracts and records and things we haven't gotten to see yet. And that doesn't take, you know, that doesn't take much more than 2 weeks. And then obviously we're producing the documents that sort of come from the, you know, that memorialize the term sheet. So, you know, so for us, I think when someone's the longer the exclusivity period, the more the entrepreneur's sort of radar should go up that maybe these guys haven't completed their work, and you know, and I think they should evaluate that term sheet versus the guy that says, you know, a lower period, and hey, you know what, and gives them that kind of firm handshake that we've done our work, we're going to do the other due diligence, which, you know, we haven't been able to do in terms of, you know, looking at contracts and things. But that's just really testing and validating the assumptions that were inherent upon the business itself. So, so that's what the no shop is, and I think it's a term that all entrepreneurs can expect. No one's going to sign a term sheet knowing that you're out continuing to be out there, because the term sheet has no value in that circumstance.
Sure.
The exclusivity period, frankly, is the only value in the term sheet, right? And from the VC's perspective, liquidation preference. There's a couple types of liquidation preference. So there's or a couple type of preferred offerings, and you know we primarily in Series A offer what's called a convertible preferred, which basically means that we either, you know, get our money back, or we convert into ownership of the company. I mean, we're equity investors. We care about growing the business and growing the value of our equity. And so we don't think we should get our money back and get our ownership in the company in a Series A. We think we should get our money back or get our ownership in the Series A. But some people, and it's increasingly prevalent, probably not so much in Series A, but later round deals where they want a participating preferred where they get their money back and they get their ownership in the company. And so that's a little more onerous on the entrepreneurs, and also, frankly, makes it more, you know, makes it more difficult. You're going to see that term in future term sheets from Series B and Series C investors. So if you're a Series A investor, you got to be careful about having too many of these terms, because you're going to have at least those terms in the future terms, and they're going to affect you, not just you and the previous owners. So, I mean, we pretty much, a standard Series A term sheet should be a convertible preferred with a single single liquidation preference, which basically means if I invest $5 million and I own 25% of the company, let's say 50%, 30% of the company, that if the company sells for $10 million, instead of taking $3 million, which would be the conversion, I would just take my $5 million, which would be my liquidation preference.
Got it. Okay, that's very clear and very fair. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say are the biggest mistakes that entrepreneurs make when trying to raise venture capital?
It's an interesting question. I think the first mistake might be raising it at all. I think they need to evaluate whether or not they need to understand what a venture capitalist cares about. And as I said before, it's building a large business that can scale quickly to multiple hundreds of millions of value in 5 to 7 years. Okay, so and being open to everything that requires. And so I think a lot of entrepreneurs, it sounds good when they're thinking about it, but A, it's not realistic, and B, they're not really completely onto that program. But beyond that, let's assuming they get past that. I think they tend to overestimate the actual size of the market and don't really do the thorough analysis that I would expect in evaluating the market size. I really like to look at, I mean, people, a lot of people come in, particularly with sort of top-down analysis that is like, well, $40 billion is spent on this, and we should be able to get, 5% of, 5% of the market, and therefore, our revenues in the year, should be, $2 billion, they make assumptions like that. And I think things need to be done on a bottoms up basis, which is, how many customers does it take at X, dollars to sell, to achieve this type of business, and is it reasonable to reach that many customers, and if so, how many salespeople do I need to do that, and how much time does that take, and how much does it cost? I think entrepreneurs should spend much more time modeling their business on a bottoms up basis. Really understanding, getting the product to market, how many people it takes to crack a customer, how long it takes, what average sales price you can get from a customer, how many units does that represent? I think there's a lot of basics that entrepreneurs overlook, and they look at things from a much more holistic, sort of overall market size, and start sort of running percentages associated with that. And I think because of that, it hurts. First of all, it hurts their credibility in the eyes of venture capitalists, and secondly, it's just not a good way to model the business. They don't really have a good understanding of how much it costs, how much it takes, and what the key sort of success factors are from the next 6 months to the next 18 months. And so I think that's probably the biggest issue that I see, is that sort of lack of understanding of the true market and how they're going to grow the business in that market.
Excellent. Greg, last question I have for you. What else about raising venture capital should entrepreneurs know about that I, forgot to ask you about?
I think it's important that entrepreneurs sort of try and build as full a team as possible. It doesn't necessarily mean full-time employees, but try and round out your team with, whether it's a board seat or advisors. These people, firstly, they're going to help you a lot. Secondly, they're going to bring a lot of validation to the business that, helps entrepreneurs. They're going to be people that we can talk to in a reference process. They're going to open doors, both suppliers, partners, in other investors, customers. I think as many good people as you can kind of surround your business with early, and obviously as many, and building a good team of actual employees and or founder employees, I think is going to be really helpful. Because I think it takes a lot of the risk out of it for venture capitalists. And I think, I think that's something that they should really look at in terms of boosting the likelihood of getting venture investing. But I think, I think I've covered most of it. I think focusing not only in the market size, but how you're going to compete with existing solutions, existing competitors, new competitors that are out there. I think, the other mistake that entrepreneurs make is sort of really underestimating the existing competition as well as the guys that they haven't heard about. I mean, I never want to see there's no competition on a slide. I think that's pretty much a quick path to a rejection if someone doesn't think that there's competition in a marketplace. So I think those are probably, and then I think, being realistic on the value of your business at this point. I think, the reality is most of these startups, the likelihood of success is very low and the outcomes are completely binary. It's either potentially a big outcome in the good scenario, and it's probably close to a zero in a bad scenario. And so entrepreneurs should be focused on getting the right partner, venture partner and others, and employees, et cetera, and less focused on dilution. Not that dilution doesn't matter, but the right venture capitalist is going to make sure the entrepreneurs have the requisite amount of ownership to make it worth their while. At some level, and so entrepreneurs should really be focused on who's going to help me the most, who's going to give me the best likelihood of succeeding. Because if I don't succeed, my greater percentage of ownership is worth zero anyway. And if I do succeed, my smaller percentage is going to be worth a lot anyway. And so I think that's the way they should be thinking about the business and who they choose as a venture partner.
Excellent, Greg. I think that was perfect. That was the information you just conveyed is going to be extremely valuable to all the entrepreneurs that listen to this. So I appreciate it.
Sure.
Once again, Greg Martin, Redpoint Ventures. You can visit them on the web at redpoint.com. Greg, once again, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks
today.
A lot, Dave. Take care. Bye.